Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's in the Video Poker Hall of Fame, and he has written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the Video Poker for Winners computer software. Michael Shackelford is the force behind the websites Wizard of Odds, Wizard of Vegas, and Wizard of Macau. An actuary by profession, Michael has been analyzing the whole gamut of casino games since 1995. His Wizard of Odds website explains the best strategies for 140 different casino games. Michael is also the author of Gambling 102, The Best Strategies for All Casino Games, and is a former adjunct professor of gaming math at UNLV. The goal of the show is that, by listening, you will be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Mike.
Good evening. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
I'm Mike Shackelford.
Tonight, our guest is Professor I. Nelson Rose, and we will be discussing his new book, Gaming Law in a Nutshell. Last week, our guest was sports handicapper Steve Fezzik, and he gave us all a betting tip. He argued that the season total for Texas A&M's college football team of 7.5 was made before their first game was rained out by Hurricane Isaac. So instead of having 6 games followed by a bye week and then another 6 games, they now had 12 weeks straight. So that made it harder. So he thinks the chances of them getting at least 7.5 games has gone down, but the line hadn't moved. He argued that betting under 7.5 at -180 was a good bet. I was convinced by his argument. After the show, I went to the Palms. Found a line there of -175, which is even better than -180. So I put down a bet. My new favorite college team is whoever is playing Texas A&M this week, which this week happens to be Florida. Next week will be somebody else. Michael, did you bet that future?
Absolutely. You were kind enough to mention that to me, and I bet that at the Venetian at the same line.
Now, I checked the Palms yesterday, and the line had moved slightly to -180. I was expecting it to move more than that, but other people would find the logic of Fezzik irrefutable, but for some reason I was wrong. So we shall see. Also last week, I mentioned the weekly contest on Friday and Saturday evenings at the Palms. It involves throwing a football. You can have a choice of throwing it from 10 feet, 15 feet, or 20 feet. You get different prize amounts if you do. I wrote about it in my weekly column on LVA.com, and that's archived on BobDancer.com, should you like to read it. Now, Michael, you mentioned you wanted to talk about this, so here's the mic. Mike?
Ah, very funny. So, yeah, this is an interesting promotion. The probability of making the shot is inversely proportional to the square of the distance from the hole. So at 10 feet away, the Palms will give you $1,000. And at 15 feet away, they give you $2,500 if you make it. And at 20 feet, they give you $4,500 in addition to a fixed, I think, $2,500 just for showing up. So the question is, what distance should you shoot it from? And at 10 feet, assuming that you have the strength to make it there, that that's not an issue, I show that the best value is to throw it from 20 feet. That has an increase in expected value of 12.5% over your value from 10 feet, no matter what your probability is from making it at 10 feet. And however, interestingly, if this promotion were done, say, putting a golf ball like they have on the golf game on The Price is Right, then it would not be inversely proportional to the square of the distance, but just the distance itself, because with a football, you have two dimensions to screw up in, whereas if you are putting, you only have one.
You actually might have three dimensions on football.
Well, what I meant was when the ball actually reaches the plane where the hole is, it's down to two dimensions. So you can screw up left or right, up and down, or some combination.
And it still might be three, because if you throw a spiral, then it's only two.
Yeah, but, and I was trying to simplify this by not getting into the spiral of the ball or anything like that.
But yeah, in my article, I argued that I would throw from 20 feet where I selected, but anybody who was throwing for me, whatever they felt most comfortable at would be fine. The difference between it is relatively small. They peg the prices pretty close to what a fair rate would be.
And I applaud them for that. The prizes were very well thought out.
All right. Now, last week we had a lawyer friend on, Brandon Phillips, and he was discussing the $1.5 million non-shuffling incident at the Golden Nugget in Atlantic City. Now, it turns out the casino has agreed to give the players all the money, so long as the players drop the lawsuits against the casino. I'm assuming the players are going to agree to do this, but I don't know that. There were some lawsuits against the casino for improper imprisonment and for racial discrimination, and I'm assuming they're getting an extra $1 million if they drop it, and it will, but they may not be. One interesting clarification in the news story was on the sequencing of the cards. Some of the people were thinking that the cards were in new deck order, such as Ace, King, Queen, Jack, 10, etc., of spades, followed by hearts, followed by diamonds. And I was arguing that could not have possibly been true because they had 14 people trying to figure out what was happening, and if it was in that order, surely somebody would have seen it. So the article says, indeed, it was in a random order determined by the card manufacturers, Jamaco. And I'm just speculating, two of spades, eight of clubs, king of hearts, king of spades, seven of diamonds, etc. But every deck was in the same sequence. So the order that they went through the shoe one time would be exactly the same order as the next time, so all you had to do was follow the pattern from the previous shoe, and you had the new pattern with 100% accuracy. So, pretty clever to notice that, although you had to be, in my mind, not so clever to be playing the game to start with, but if you were playing the game and noticed that, then you had a big payday.
Yeah, congratulations to the players for figuring it out. And maybe what happened is they noticed that the average baccarat hand has five cards, so maybe they noticed every 10 hands the same pattern of banker and player wins was repeating. And perhaps then they said to themselves, how is it this pattern is repeating? And maybe it's because the cards are in the same order. And by the way, I hope they don't settle and just take the money and waive their right to sue, because I think that the casino has a terrible case against them and they have a great case against the casino.
Maybe, but the casino still has $1 million of their money.
Yeah, that's true. So maybe they will look at it in terms of the utility of money and take it, which they probably will do. But I would like to see the casino punished somehow for illegally detaining them.
Okay, we want to spank that casino.
Yes, we do.
Okay, yeah. Now, I don't know that, like, the $1 million that is owed to the players, it may not be owed to them equally. There's one of the players in particular was backroomed and held captive for many hours. And they may not owe him any money. So if that's the case, then he would not have any reason to settle, whereas the others would be begging him to settle because they didn't care about the back rooming and they just wanted the money. So it's possible that one lawyer is representing all of them, or it's possible there have a number of lawyers involved. And so we'll see.
Well, he has a tough decision to make.
There is a new case in a new casino is approved, the preliminary approval for doing online poker in Nevada, and that would be ACEP, which is America's Casino something. And they run both Arizona Charlie's, Stratosphere, and the Aquarius down in Laughlin. And so there's still a preliminary approval. The South Point is the only one with final approval, but it keeps expanding. So I'm not sure how many casinos will eventually be in the mix. I have a friend who plays video poker probably 25 hours a week. And if you watch him play, he seems to be in constant agony. Every time he gets dealt three of a kind, he plays 10 play. Every time he gets dealt three of a kind, which happens every 47 hands, or probably 10, 11 times an hour, if he doesn't get at least one four of a kind, it's like, oh, and he pulls his hair out, and he groans, and it's like you'd think he lost his best friend. Now, you're going to get zero something like 65% of the time. It's really close to that number. So if there were 11 chances to do it, then 7 times he's going to fail. And so 7 times an hour just on that hand, talk about, and if he ever gets 4 to the Royal and he doesn't hit one of those, it's like you'd think his dog died. And so he's going through this agony over and over and over again. And yet he is and he seems to love the game. He keeps coming back over and over and over again. So, Mike, do you know people who seem to be in such agony but obviously love the game because they keep going back for this agony every day?
Yes, I generally find these kinds of players to be very annoying, that think they're entitled to win every single bet, and sometimes they even find a way to complain even when they win. Like, let's say they were dealt 4 to a Royal on 10 play, and they hit one, and darn, I'm unhappy because I should have hit 2. You know, I think it's really annoying. But sometimes it can be done in a funny way. Like, there's a video on YouTube about the world's angriest RV salesman, and it's outtakes of this RV salesman where he's just cussing and screaming about the bugs and that he's forgetting his lines and every little thing that's going wrong, and it's you don't know whether to laugh or cry, but it's really a great video.
It's interesting. So right now we're having trouble getting Professor Rose on the line. The reason is because I gave our producer a fax number. Now I'm giving him the regular number, so he should have better chance getting it. So while he gets Professor Rose on the line, I want to talk about next week. Our guest is going to be Nathaniel Tilton. Now, this is a name none of us have heard about before, but he wrote a book called The Blackjack Life. It's recently published by Huntington Press, that's LVA, Anthony Curtis. And he plays on a two-person team, and they have put together a blackjack played differently than anybody else. And so they were allowed to play for many, many years with much less heat than the other people had. They used some of the same technique as the MIT team and some of the others, but a lot of them were different as well. So we're going to be talking to Nathaniel Tilton next Thursday night. And in 2 weeks, we're going to be talking to Michael Fields, who's vice president of VideoPoker.com, who is one of our sponsors. They have the triple play machines and spin poker and quick quads and super times pay and a whole bunch of other games. So a lot of the fun games in video poker are by Action Gaming, and so hopefully he's gonna be on in 2 weeks. So Lawrence is still having a little bit of trouble getting
Professor Rose on the phone. So, Michael, why don't you tell us what's new happening at the Wizard websites?
I just published a page titled The 10 Commandments for Table Game Inventors. As long as I talked about the 10 Commandments 2 weeks ago, I decided to make another 10 Commandments. And this is one about all the things that game inventors should and should not do to try to come up with a successful new casino table game. So if you are interested in that business, please have a look.
All right. Are there any you can share with us now, or what would be the most important one? Or
the first commandment of new table games is to keep it simple. And as someone who has consulted with many game inventors, they often give you a game that takes half an hour to explain or 20 pages of rules. And nothing like that is ever going to fly in the casino. A good rule of thumb is that you should be able to explain the rules of a game in 30 seconds or less. And I frequently see new game inventors that take 30 minutes to explain their game.
Uh-huh. That's a good first rule. So we have Professor Rose on the phone. So let me introduce him and we'll get started. Professor I. Nelson Rose is a full professor with tenure at Whittier Law School and visiting professor at the University of Macau, an internationally known scholar, author, and public speaker, and he's recognized as one of the world's leading experts on gaming law. Professor Rose is best known for his internationally syndicated column and his 1986 landmark book, Gambling and the Law. Professor Rose is co-editor-in-chief of the Gaming Law Review and Economics. He often acts as a consultant and expert witness for players, governments, and the gaming industry. Tonight, we are specifically addressing Professor Rose's new book, Gaming Law in a Nutshell. Professor Rose, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Well, thank you for inviting me.
It's good to have you back again.
Great.
Your new book is a sort of cliff notes for lawyers, but I found it quite readable and, generally speaking, not too advanced for me to understand.
Uh-huh.
Since our radio audience consists of gamblers who are primarily non-lawyers, how will this book be useful to them?
Well, anyone who has gone to law school knows about the Nutshell series, which is one of these great aids for law students. And, of course, law students are often just, you know, they obviously are not lawyers. They haven't yet gone through the whole legal education. And it's a way to explain pretty simply and clearly, okay, here is this entire area of law, like here's the law of gaming law or the law of contracts or evidence or one of those. It's also very useful for lawyers who may know part of the field and don't know others. But in fact, I wrote it in a way that your average person could read it and get what they need out of it, so they could start understanding why the laws are so bizarre and, you know, what their rights are, what they can do about things if they think things aren't going the way they're supposed to be. I think it would be useful for the average reader as well.
Now, do you think this might be useful for, say, a freshman year class in law?
Oh, absolutely. It's good for anyone who has an interest in an area of law, like, say, internet. They want to know, hey, am I going to get arrested for playing internet poker? Or they wrote a check, a marker that bounced, and they got a nasty note that says, hey, we're going to come and arrest you for that. Or even the other side, that they got a winning slot machine jackpot, and now the casino doesn't want to pay off. So it's a way of saying, okay, here's where this all came from, and here's what's happening. And also, because there's so much going on around the world, and I teach every summer in Macau, which is by far the biggest casino jurisdiction in the world now, I'm sorry, the phone dropped. I threw in a lot of information about legal gambling in every part of the world. so that it also, you know, like there really hasn't been anything written about Canada. And so this book talks about the gaming law in Canada as well.
Well, I look forward to reading it, and I'm sorry I didn't have time to read it before our interview.
It just came out, so that's understandable, and you can find it on my website, gamblingandthelaw.com. There's a link for it.
Okay. Well, thank you for forgiving me. Now, Bob says that that your book says that in Nevada, a casino may sue a player to collect a bet, but a player may not sue a casino to collect a bet the casino refuses to pay. A famous case of a blackjack player who used a false passport as ID won $84,000 from the Monte Carlo casino, who refused to pay. The player took the case to the Gaming Control Board, where he lost. He eventually appealed it up to the Nevada Supreme Court and won, barely. Now, doesn't this violate the provision that a player can't sue a casino in Nevada?
Well, a player cannot sue a casino for a gambling debt. And I had a case of a 19-year-old boy who won $1 million at a slot machine at Caesar's Palace, and they refused to pay him because he was under 21. Ended up taking that to the U.S. Supreme Court, and unfortunately, because players can't sue casinos, the court said, sorry, you know, you don't have any rights. Casinos have the right to sue players if it's a written marker, but players can't sue casinos. But what you can do is you can go to the Gaming Control Board and ask them and say, hey, I deserve to win. And unfortunately, in the case I was involved in, they sided with the casino. Here, the board originally sided with the casino because that blackjack player had a phony ID. And then when it went to the Nevada Supreme Court, the Nevada Supreme Court ruled, who cares? It didn't make any difference on whether or not he won or lost that he was carrying a phony ID, and therefore they ordered the Gaming Control Board to order the casino to pay.
Now, I'm still a little confused. If a player is unhappy with the judgment of the Gaming Control Board, can he take it through the conventional courts?
You can. The problem is that all courts give all administrative agencies, not just the Gaming Control Board, but the Department of Motor Vehicles. I mean, anybody, the FCC. Courts give great deference to administrative agencies because they don't want people filing lawsuits if, you know, the DMV takes your license for drunk driving. They don't want you to then be taking that to the Supreme Court. So you have the right. The problem is they overwhelmingly side with the administrative agency. So when you take something to the Gaming Control Board, in any state, and whatever the board commission decides, you can take it to court, but it's very, very rare that you win, because you have to show that the casino regulator was wrong as a matter of law. In this particular case, the majority of the Nevada Supreme Court ruled that, yes, the Nevada Gambling Control Board was wrong as a matter of law, because it said he had the player had a phony ID, and the court said, well, but he didn't cheat the casino. He didn't do anything wrong. Yeah, you're not supposed to have a phony ID, but what does that have to do with the casino not paying him when he wins?
But if they ruled that way, how come when an underage player does win a jackpot, the casino refuses to pay?
Well, that's a great question. Now, I should say on the Nevada Supreme Court case, the dissent did say that the blackjack card counter should not have been paid because their theory was he had shown that phony ID to the casino and was allowed to play in a high-limit game that he wouldn't have been allowed to play in. So at least there was an argument the other way. With an underage player who wins, back when I took that case, it's called the Erickson case, we went to the Nevada Supreme Court, we went to the United States Supreme Court. The law in Nevada wasn't clear. It simply said you're not supposed to let children, minors, play, or people under 21. Nevada legislature has now changed that to make it really clear that the casino gets to keep the money, which I think is a very bad political decision. But on the other hand, they have finally started imposing fines on casinos for allowing underage players to gamble. Because, see, it used to be if a child was gambling and lost, the casino kept the money. If the child won, they would check the ID and keep the money, and no casino had ever been fined a penny. Now the Nevada regulators are fining casinos, and so are regulators in other states, and most of the casinos are not going to want to risk losing their license over trying to let some underage player win.
All right, let's change the subject a little bit. Yep. Let's say we have a video poker jackpot in dispute.
Uh-huh.
Now, I'm a video poker jackpot, and I think I've hit a royal flush.
Yes.
And the casino argues that it's a machine malfunction.
Right.
Now my question is, how would the process of adjudicating this, the shorthand version, how would the process of adjudicating this be different in Nevada than, say, in California, which only has Indian casinos?
Well, at least in Nevada you have a state regulator who has the power to require the casino to pay. But even in Nevada, they have signs that say a malfunction voids play, and what I don't like about the Nevada law is they determine whether there's a malfunction by the secret computer that's inside the slot machine. In other words, let's say you really see three bars across, and it's flashing, and then they open it up and say, nope, the internal computer that you didn't even know about says you didn't win, therefore we don't have to pay. And I think that's a horrible law, but that's kind of the way the cases are going in Nevada. The problem with Indian casinos in California is it is up to the tribe, the Tribal Gaming Commission, which is part of the tribe almost always, to decide whether the player gets paid. You can go to the state, but when Gray Davis was the governor, he gave away the rights. He didn't insist that the state could force a tribe to pay any money to anybody. So you can't get a state, an outside third party, to look at it and decide whether or not the casino can pay. Instead, it's the tribe, which owns the casino, has a tribal gaming commission, which is almost always made up of their own members of the tribe, and they decide whether or not there was a malfunction and whether they're going to pay you.
So let's say I have a dispute with the Barona Casino. Is that going to be heard by members of the Barona tribe, or might it be a larger organization of Native Americans?
Well, every tribe has to have a gaming commission. I don't know what that one is in particular. So a lot of times, if the tribe is big enough, they will have members of the tribe on the commission. If a smaller tribe, they may in fact use other members of other tribes, or even a lot of times outsiders who are paid to be commissioners. And I have to say, I think the commissioners do try to do what's right. They know also that if they say there's a malfunction and there wasn't a malfunction, the word will get out and people will stop going to the casino.
Okay. On another topic, one of the sponsors of this show, the South Point Casino, has been the only casino so far authorized in Nevada to conduct online poker.
Yes.
Using your crystal ball, how long will it be before we see intrastate internet gambling in Nevada, and how will it be different from what we had before Black Friday?
Intrastate or interstate?
I said intrastate, which means just players within Nevada playing against each other.
I think it'll be fast. You've already got now sports betting, which you can use on a mobile device anywhere in the state. And the regulators were told by the legislature last year, as a nice coincidence for Nevada, it was before the federal Department of Justice reversed its decision about the Wire Act, which was the main statute used against internet gambling. The state legislature of Nevada told the regulators, draw up regulations for internet poker for when it ever becomes legal. So they started work before the Christmas announcement by the Obama administration that says a state can legalize intrastate internet gambling. And so they've been issuing licenses since early summer. Now, you know, you've got a casino that's actually got one of the licenses. They've got the technology part. Shouldn't be that hard because they've already okayed devices for sports betting. So I think it'll be before the end of the year you will have intrastate internet poker in Nevada. The interesting question is, how long is it going to be before they do interstate? Because I think there is now no federal law that prevents Nevada from pooling players with other states. Delaware, for example, also now has legal internet poker. They have, in fact, internet casinos. So you could have Delaware and Nevada. I think Iowa, New Jersey are going to follow quickly. And then the interesting question is, can they even take players from, say, England? If it's legal on both ends, if it's legal under Nevada law, it's legal under the law of Delaware, and it's legal under the law of the United Kingdom, I think that there's no federal law that says you can't do that. You get around the liquidity problem. You've got enough players to have basically any game at any stake at any time of the day or night.
And what does your crystal ball say going past that and looking at sports betting and casino gambling?
Sports betting is tough. The major problem, there's two problems. One is the Wire Act still does exist. And it's been limited now to bets on sports events and races, but it still says you can't do it interstate. And so that's a problem. The other statute, though, is called the Federal Professional and Amateur Sports Protection Act, and it says no state can legalize any form of sports betting unless it already has it in place. Well, New Jersey voters approved at the ballot box legalizing sports betting, and the state legislature approved it, and the governor signed it, and New Jersey is in court. In California, and I'm kind of responsible for this, it's a funny story, but there's a bill that passed the state Senate, and by almost unanimous vote, and is pending in the state assembly to allow sports betting in California. And again, they would have to challenge this federal law that says, no, sorry, you can't do it. I think when the courts get the challenge, I think they are going to rule the law unconstitutional. There are about a dozen states in this country that have various forms of sports betting, including highlight, which clearly is sports betting. And you've got lots of, there's sports books in, say, Montana and North Dakota, where, you know, people don't realize Wyoming, there's a lot of sports betting, legal sports betting in this country. There's like a dozen states that are allowed it. And then we have this federal law that says, oh, I'm sorry, New Jersey, California, every other state, you can't have it. And that's just irrational. It's like saying Nevada and a few other states can have sound in their movie theaters, but all the other movie theaters, you're not allowed to have talkies. Sorry. So I think the court will throw that out. But they won't be able to go across state lines like they could with, like, internet poker, because the Wire Act is still a good law and will be upheld as a valid law.
Now, speaking of the Wire Act, and you mentioned just before Christmas,
yeah,
the administration said that it only pertains to sports betting and internet poker was okay. Part of the Republican...
Yes.
Platform says we like the Wire Act the way it used to be, and it's going to hurt families and it'll destroy families if we allow internet poker. Now, I'm guessing that very few people use gambling as their main reason to choose a president or a congressman, but how much of the future of internet gaming is dependent on who wins the election?
Well, I think this may be a time when people can use gambling as a guide on what to vote for, because this that decision is astounding. The Republican Party has become the party of big government. They want to tell you, they want to be there in the wedding chapel, in the bedroom, in the doctor's office, when, especially if you're a woman, they want to be there when you're in your home office, when you want to play legal internet poker inside the state of Nevada. And so they're trying to impose, they're taking freedom away from people. But what's amazing about that decision is they're taking freedom away from the states. They're stomping on states' rights. They're actually saying the state of Nevada doesn't have the right to determine its own policy about what forms of gambling are legal. And I've never seen, you know, I know the Republican Party has always been, you know, pretty right-wing and on social issues, but now they're stepping on not just individuals but states, saying we know better than the people of Nevada. And this is the position of the Republican Party from the very top all the way through the U.S. Senate and Congress and down to the local level. I think it's a very scary position to take. I think, fortunately, this may be one of the few times that it's fortunate that we have such a stalemate in Congress. You know, the Republicans control the House, the Democrats control the Senate. So since the Republicans took over the House of Representatives in January 2011, there has been literally no new substantive law passed in the Congress, except for a little bit of change in patent laws. All they have done, all the Congress has done, is voted to approve naming post offices and to they've reluctantly agreed to continue the FAA, you know, so that airports could be built, but nothing is going to get done, which means you're not going to get any, they're not going to repeal the decision of the Obama Department of Justice. All and right. Say,
so let's yeah. We're trying to limit our political discussions to gambling, and we are a little bit off of there. So, Michael, why don't you ask him a question about...
Well, that is a gambling issue, because I don't think that Congress will act to change any gambling law either way. They're not going to legalize internet gambling under federal law, and I don't think they're going to outlaw, let's say, Nevada internet gambling.
So no matter what the Republican platform is, it
doesn't matter, because you've got to have both houses and the president.
Okay.
Well, I'm sure all the Ron Paul supporters are applauding you right now.
I don't know. I never quite know which way they're going to come down on an issue. Although I have to say, I really liked Ron Paul's saying that he actually is in favor of legalizing heroin. And that coming out of a Republican debate, presidential debate, that was really a kick in the head.
good old Uncle Ron. Okay. All right. Change of topic. Very recently, a federal judge in New York ruled. Very recently, a federal judge in New York ruled that poker does not constitute illegal gambling under the Internet Gambling Business Act. This was only a district judge, not an appellate court ruling or higher. Does this ruling matter, and if so, how?
It really doesn't matter as much as it could legally. That decision was reported that a judge decided that poker is a game of skill, and therefore it's legal. That's not what he said. He said, poker is a game of skill, at least enough under this statute, this one federal statute, the Illegal Gambling Businesses Act. But he actually, in the opinion, came right out and said, you should have charged him under New York state law because poker is illegal gambling under New York state law. So it does take away one more federal law that can be used against internet poker, but it doesn't do anything about the state laws. It also doesn't quite make sense. I mean, how can it be a game of skill under one statute but not a game of skill under another? It doesn't quite make sense, and I'm afraid it has caused a lot of interest, but I don't think it's going to be much in the terms of a legal precedent.
Okay. Now, hypothetically, let's assume Shaq and I, we both live in Nevada, and we decided to pool money to bet on
NFL football games this coming season. Now, this isn't really happening, but for now, let's assume it is. Now, assume I put up the most money and Michael has the most expertise.
Yes.
Now, we work out a formula to share wins and losses. Now, is this an agreement we should put in writing? Is this something we need? Are we breaking a law by doing this? Do we need an attorney? What?
You don't need an attorney. You should put it in writing, just like you should put any agreement in writing of any importance, so that there won't be a dispute later. You're not breaking the law, but it's not enforceable. It's probably not enforceable. Remember, in Nevada, gambling debts are not enforceable except for written markers that are when a casino can sue a player. Now, having said that, the Supreme Court also did allow enforcement of backers of a player in the World Series of Poker when we had a winner who didn't want to pay, and the court said, had to struggle with this idea that, can gambling really be against the public policy of Nevada? That seems so strange. And I believe they said that they would enforce it. So maybe it is enforceable. I can't tell you for sure. I can tell you you would have a problem in California, where it clearly would be actually against the law. It actually would be a misdemeanor, although nobody has ever been arrested for making social bets on anything that I know of.
Well, I actually know of a case where somebody was arrested for betting $5 on a backgammon game.
I meant for sports betting.
Well, let's say that it's not a matter of a dispute about a financial arrangement, but let's say I have a friendly bet with somebody, and we just have an argument about the resolution. For example, there was a Super Bowl prop bet about whether or not Madonna would be wearing fishnet stockings in the halftime show, and she ended up wearing fishnet pantyhose. And there was a huge debate about who should win this bet. And let's say that two private individuals make this bet with each other. They absolutely are at a standstill. Would the courts even consider hearing this dispute? Or is it an illegal bet to begin with, therefore they have nothing to do with it?
Well, I'm certainly glad we're not talking about something frivolous like presidential politics, and we have now got to Madonna's fishnet pantyhose.
Touche.
Yes, there you go. It's an interesting question. In most states of the United States, it clearly would not be enforceable. It wouldn't be illegal, but what the court says is we leave the parties as we find them. Meaning, if you've paid, and then you decide, wait a minute, that wasn't really stockings, you can't go to court and get your money back either. You can't enforce it. You know, in both respects, it's probably not enforceable. If it's a big enough bet where it's worth, you know, let's say it's a $100,000 bet or something, and it's just between a couple people. My recommendation, I've never seen this done, but my recommendation would be to put in an arbitration clause that would say, in case of dispute, we appoint somebody, and you have somebody you both trust, to decide it. And then you're not asking the court to decide, it's a private agreement. Now, technically, that's also probably not enforceable in law, but most people do abide by, you know, the arbitration agreement. And arbitration, the courts like arbitration because they don't have to hear the cases. But you probably would, if it's a $100,000 bet, then it's probably worth going to a lawyer who knows gambling law, who can say, okay, let's choose a state where we know this is enforceable, and we'll put in the agreement that this shall be enforced under the laws of whatever state that is.
Well, maybe,
and I don't know what state there is.
Maybe we need younger justices. They would be interested in hearing about Madonna's pantyhose. But anyway.
You're right.
All
you're right.
Now, the Full Tilt situation seems to be coming to a conclusion. But American players still haven't been paid.
Yeah. I think they will have to be paid or that name is dead. And the real big winner of this is PokerStars, where they had the money to pay back all their players right away, and now they've bought one of their biggest competitors, put them out of business, and they will be paying people back. Otherwise, what they bought when they took over Full Tilt was nothing. If you don't pay the players back, it doesn't matter whether they get their license back or not. Nobody's going to trust them again.
So if someone wishes to obtain a copy of your book, Gambling Law in a Nutshell, what is the best way to get it?
Gaming Law in a Nutshell is probably the easiest thing is to go to my website, Gambling and the Law, all four words spelled out in full and strung together, gamblingandthelaw.com, and right on the first page you click on the lower left, there's a link to the publisher, and you get them directly from the publisher.
If they want to get in touch with you because maybe they know a minor who got a jackpot, would using your website be the best way to do that?
Thank you. I do have a link on there for contacting me, and in fact I get questions all the time. I do have to apologize that a lot of times I can't get back to people real fast sometimes, but I try. And so, sure, if they've got a question, they can go to gamblingandthelaw.com and send it on to me.
Very good. Professor, this is your third visit here, I think. You're very knowledgeable. It was very enlightening. We thank you very much for taking your time tonight.
I do. Anytime I can do a radio show where we talk about heroin and Madonna's pantyhose, we're doing fine. So, and the presidency. So this is a great show. Thank you so much for inviting me.
Good night, Professor.
Good night. Great to be on the show. Thank you.
All right, Michael. So other than Madonna's pantyhose, what did we learn tonight?
I really did have a bet on that, by the way.
Did you?
I did.
Did you win it?
I did not. I bet that she would... How did it go? I bet that she would not have the fishnet pantyhose I bet she would not have fishnet stockings. And so my friend bet that she would. And then she came out with the fishnet pantyhose. And my friend asked to be paid, and I paid him because I thought that the spirit of the bet was, would she have fishnet anything, you know, on her legs. And even though I know some people who would have stuck to the letter of the law and not paid in my shoes, you know, I am a big believer in looking at the spirit of the bet. So that's why I paid. But what did I learn tonight? I learned a lot about the current status of things in online poker. And that's something I get asked about all the time. So we just had probably the best opinion there is out there on the law and internet gambling. So I learned a lot from that.
Yeah, I frequently get questions on class 2 and class 3 machines and stuff. And some of the questions get into areas that I'm not sure about. So we didn't ask questions about it tonight, but I did skim the book on that area. And so there's clear definitions. Mm-hmm. And so should questions come up on the machines and stuff, this is a good, I'm glad that I got a reference copy of this book as part of the show. I thought that was, I'm glad to have it. The South Point has more than 10,000 video poker games returning more than 99%. This is more than anyone else. On Mondays through Thursdays, there's an opportunity to earn a free lunch for 300 points or free dinner buffet for 600 points, and you get to keep the points. The South Point's the first casino approved by the Nevada Gaming Control Board to operate online poker games. There's a free site now, southpointpoker.com, which will disappear when the real money gets going. So if you're a Nevada resident who plays poker, it's probably a good idea to have at least a small presence on the free site, because you'll probably get promotional offers when the real money site begins. And promotional offers on poker sites mean money. My next free semester of video poker classes will start on Tuesday, September 18th. That's a week and a half from now. It's at noon. It's in the showroom. The first class is Jacks Are Better. So compared to my last semester at the South Point, this time we will teach Bonus Poker Deluxe and in place of Jacks Are Better Multi-Strike. The other nine classes will be the same. at the Palms. The weekly drawings take place Friday and Saturday night. It's throwing a football. The first person throws it and gets cash, and the next five people get 10% of what the first place person gets. So we've spoken about that quite a bit tonight already. Now, for the next week, Monday, Wednesday, Friday, PEWs, play, earn, and win. For the first half of September is you get a do-it-yourself theme, and there's themes like tools and gift cards to Lowe's. Lowe's is a home improvement place. Second half of the month will feature a sports theme with gift cards to Sports Authority, balls, bats, coolers, that type of thing. All right. So in a couple weeks, we have G2E. Now, G2E is Global Gaming Expo. It's a convention in Las Vegas where all the people from all over the world come to the new machines are unveiled, whether they're slot machines, video poker machines, table games, whether there's uniforms to sell or cashier things or advertising agency, anything at all to do with the casino business will be at G2E. So, Michael, you usually go to this, don't you?
Yeah, I've been 13 times in a row now. And I go to other gaming shows as well, but the G2E is the huge gaming show of the year in the whole world. And I think if you have even the smallest interest in gambling, you would have a good and educational time at the show.
All right. So next week we will probably be announcing on the air a way for you to go for free. We have to dot some I's and cross some T's, but probably next week we're going to be able to do that.
Yes, when you sign up, on the very first screen, there's a place you can put in a promotion code, and there's already some code in there, but it's worthless. If you put in a good code, then you get in for free. Otherwise, it's going to cost you $200 for just an expo pass, and it's like $2,000 for to attend the talks.
The seminars. So when you go to the gaming show, what do you look for?
I'm, of course, interested in the table games, and I visit every single one of them. I play all of them. I chat with the inventors and the people behind them and, of course, the beautiful models dealing them. And
in that order?
No, in the opposite order. You know, you've asked before, why are there so many pretty girls on my website? And many of those pictures were taken at the gaming show.
Yeah, so you select games on the basis of who has the best booth babes.
Well, I don't judge a game by that, but it makes the whole show fun. And by the way, my game, Mulligan Poker, is going to be there this year at the Shuffle Master booth. So I'm looking forward to actually seeing a game of my own there for once.
Are you going to be in the booth demonstrating it or talking about it? Or
no, they will have someone much better than me. They always have very lovely models at Shuffle Master. So,
well, yeah, but their job is to look good. Your job is to explain the game. It's different.
Oh, it's more important to look good.
Okay, maybe that's my problem. Okay, and I spend most of my time looking at machine games, whether it is IGT video poker or there's other games of skill. So good night, everybody. Go out and hit lots of Royal Flush. See you next week.
Good night.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford. Archived versions of past shows may be found on bobdancer.com and wizardofodds.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Michael Shackelford are both on Facebook and welcome your input or questions. Our sponsors are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the Palms Casino Resort, the website videopoker.com, and the website wizardofodds.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge. Money.